I'm delighted to say we do have a speaker this evening. They're going to share with us for 40-45 minutes their experience, faith and hope journey to, through and into Narcotics Anonymous. And I'm going to hand you over to Helena, who's going to introduce them. So, Helena, over to you.
Hi everyone, I'm Elaine. I'm an addict.
Hi, Helena.
Hello.
Hello. Yeah,
Hi.
hi, Helena.
Hi. What an amazing opportunity it is for me to be asking this very special person to come and share with us for 40 to 45 minutes. I've been hearing her many times and every time thinking, oh, I wish I could hear her longer. And now that I found this speakers meeting, I found a way to invite, these beautiful sharers. So, Anna, with no further ado, thank you for coming to share with us tonight.
Hi, I just before I start, I'd like to know if you guys are going to give me any kind of heads up or warning about the time, or I could
Yeah,
time myself.
I can do that, Anna. Yeah.
Or
Not
I could maybe I could time myself. I just need to put it up. How long did you say?
40 to
40,
40.
45 minutes, so whatever you're comfortable with.
Oh my God.
You have
Yes.
that, yeah, go for it. Fantastic, fantastic.
Okay.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you,
Go on,
Steve.
Anna.
Hello, everybody. Thank you. A particular thank you to Elaine for inviting me. And even more so, God, I'm still a bit lost because I'm still trying to put the timer on. There you go. And I'm done now. Okay. Oh God, I need to center myself. Yeah, thank you, Elaine. Thank you guys for listening to me, and thank you, Elaine, for inviting me, and thank you for warning me today. I'm usually this is not like me, I'm the kind of person that when I'm asked to do service in whatever capacity, I always say yes, unless I can't do it. And if it's something like a share, I put it in my diary and I actually remember, I don't know what happened today. I think it's probably a combination of getting older. My short-term memory is terrible, not having gone into my diary on my phone and checked what I had on for today. And just being really busy because I'm having my garden done and I've got to kind of do it with this person who's doing it for me. Otherwise, I'm going to finance his next house because it's going to be a really kind of expensive affair. So we've been chipping in, me and my partner, and I was kind of feeling this skip and I'm really tired and I completely forgot and I'm so sorry. Oh God. I usually like to kind of, have a bit of a plan, and today I really don't have one. So if it all comes out kind of upside down, I apologize in advance. So my name is Anne, and I'm an addict, and I'm Portuguese, and I'm 57, and I've known of this fellowship for over 30 years. I think I went to my first meeting and heard about NA and the fellowship in the late 80s. And that was back in Portugal, in my home country. So I'm from the capital, Lisbon, and fortunately, they have lots of meetings. Even in those days, in the late 80s, when the fellowship was still quite young. There was at least two to three meetings every single day, which was a total treat. And I think once I knew about it, I think it might have been my godmother actually, who told my parents. She knew of someone and she told my parents when she heard about my problems with addiction. She said, "Oh, there's this place where she can go, and it's free." By then, my parents had already paid for all kinds of things, psychiatrists, naltrexone, combinations of uppers and downers, you know, and kind of lots of medications that would leave me a bit like a zombie. And can't remember if they had, no, and then they sent me to rehab as well. But none of those things kind of worked first time. But I was really glad and I was really pleased that they have, even though at the time I was just paying lip service. I was doing what I was supposed to do just to get them off my back. But I was very determined to kind of keep on using, you know. As far as I was concerned, I was kind of in the beginning of my drug-taking career, and I had hardly started, you know. I certainly wasn't prepared to stop. And it's funny, really, because I kind of had consequences very early on in my kind of active addiction history, you know. It's like I started using when I was about probably 14, 13, 14. And that was kind of, you know, weed, hashish, and kind of uppers and downers. And then by 16, I was freebasing cocaine. And then by 18, I tried heroin and I fell in love with it. It was just a drug that did what I wanted it to do. You know, all the other drugs, I didn't even particularly was into them. Certainly cocaine, I remember thinking I'm going to have a heart attack and die each time I took it. But I took it nonetheless, you know. Obviously, at the time, I didn't know about addiction and I couldn't really understand, probably didn't ask myself the question, why am I taking the drug that I think is going to kill me, you know. But that's how it was. And then when I tried heroin, it was just like, this is the drug, you know, this is the medicine to my ailments, you know, this is what I need. I need oblivion, you know. And within a few months of start taking it, I realized that I had smoked like copious amounts, you know. I didn't have a job. I kept my habit by stealing off my parents, my relatives, my parents' friends, stuff like that. So it was really difficult to kind of keep up my habit because there was kind of limited opportunities to kind of steal and make money. So I kind of engineered, well, first I observed that the friends I had or the people I knew in my neighborhood that injected drugs didn't need the same amounts that I needed when I was smoking. So I thought, no, that's what I need. I need to learn how to inject myself and then I'll need, you know, like a quarter of the amounts that I'm using at the moment. And I can't afford it anyway. I don't know where to find the money to do it. So kind of that's what I did. I bottled the paraphernalia. I locked myself in my parents' bathroom and I was determined to come out an expert. Oh, also, I forgot to mention, I didn't want to share my drugs either, which was something that I had to do the first times I injected because I didn't know how to inject myself. So I had to ask people to do it for me. And obviously, I had to share my drugs, which was something I wasn't very happy about doing. So that's what happened. And as a result of that, I got hepatitis B and hepatitis C within like 6 months of starting injecting myself. And that was like consequences in my face straight away, you know. But at the time, it didn't kind of make sense to me. I remember ending up, then that's when my parents kind of found out I was taking drugs because before they thought there's something wrong with her, but we don't know what it is, you know. And then when I ended up in hospital having a liver biopsy and being treated in a ward by a friend of my parents who was like the head person for that, I think it was a contagious tropical disease or contagious disease department at one of the main hospitals in Lisbon. She was a friend of my parents, Joana, and she obviously realized once she examined me, she realized that the reason why I had hepatitis and was in hospital was because I was injecting myself with drugs. So she said, "Oh, we're going to have to tell your parents." And until then, it was like my worst fear was that my parents would find out about this kind of, you know, sideline lifestyle, really. But then they did, and then it was a massive relief. And then what had been my worst fear until then became just total kind of, you know, total kind of, you know, permission to, for me to kind of really go at it now, you know, because I'm not trying to hide. I'm not trying to steal just a little bit so they don't notice. I'm not trying to pretend, you know, now I can go at it and I don't have to make excuses or try to make up lies to kind of justify what's going on. You know, I can just, now it's all out in the open. It was my worst nightmare, but now that's happened and the world hasn't come to an end. I might as well kind of, you know, full throttle really on my addiction, because now I don't have to lie and pretend anymore. And obviously within 6 months, I'm a bit flustered because I didn't sit and I didn't relax and I didn't kind of took my time before I came to the meeting because I completely forgot I was sharing. Anyway, so happy, Hep C, and then a couple of years later, I got HIV as well. And that was a different ball game, you know. By then I had been to treatment, but it hadn't worked. And I'd been to a day program back in Lisbon, it hadn't worked. I'd been to a couple of psychiatrists and been on all kinds of combinations of drugs to kind of keep me away from street ones. I think the second psychiatrist I saw, my parents were saying, "Well, she doesn't stop using." So he said, "Oh, I'm going to give her this drug that will make her stop using because she won't feel the drugs," which was naltrexone. And I think what I did, because in the beginning my dad would make me take, it wasn't an implant or anything, it was like a pill. And in the beginning my dad would make me drink it in front of him, take it in front of him in the morning. So I started doing cocaine, you know, and then eventually I think he stopped kind of being so observant about making me take it in the morning in front of him. And then I just kind of went back to my old ways, you know. And that was my life with active addiction in Portugal. You know, speedball was the thing really. That's the drugs I was doing. I was mixing up cocaine and heroin and putting it all in the spoon and kind of doing it every day, as many times a day as I could. All the money, all the kind of opportunities to kind of steal, manipulate, you know, steal other things that I could transform into cash, you know, all the opportunities. I was just like on the hunt, really. I was on a mission to kind of get as much money as I could to go and use. And then I decided to come to England. So I had a boyfriend at the time who was also in the fellowship. And when I met him, he was clean and I was clean. And it was all very exciting. But within a few months, we were both back using. And then he came to England because he was also HIV positive and they'd been told that if it came to England, he could get, you know, he could get AZT and he could have some medication to kind of help him deal with the symptoms and the illness. So he came to England and then he kept in touch with me and tried to convince me to come over. And I still remember he said, "Oh, come over and we'll go on a methadone script. We'll go to the DDU and we'll go on a methadone script and we'll sort ourselves out. And then we'll be able to kind of get all the support because this country is absolutely wonderful, you know, and will give us anything we need from housing to money to money to eat, you know, and pay the bills and, you know, and support with our medical problems and blah blah blah. So I kind of thought, oh my God. And so I did come to England, and it was in some kind of bed and breakfast in Nice Street, Kensington, waiting for me so he could put the papers in to try and get a house, because he wanted a house to be in both our names, and he was waiting for me to do that. And unfortunately, things didn't go that well, because obviously we did get a methadone script, but it was just like to put in the cupboards, you know, for the days that we woke up sick and we had to kind of be okay to go and shoplift or go and do whatever to get money for drugs or get drugs, you know. So it was basically in the cupboard. Sometimes we'd sell some, sometimes we'd take some ourselves if we were too sick and didn't have any money for drugs. But other than that, that's all that methadone script and that, you know, ticket to freedom kind of meant. And then he got ill, and then he got ill and died, and that was like really scary, because I think I moved from my parents' house and my country to come over here and expect this guy, his name was Louis, and expect Louis to kind of look after me and take over the role of my parents, you know, look after me and provide for me and protect me. And then he died and I was on my own, you know, and that was a bit of a scary situation. Also, he died in the middle of the night. I remember waking up and he was dead in bed, and I just like totally freaked out, you know. It took many hours for the situation to kind of be solved, you know, because it's like, I think the first people I had to ring was the police, and the police came, but obviously the police can't kind of, they can see he's dead, but they can't say he's dead. So they had to call the coroners, and then the coroner came and said, yes, he is dead. And then they had to call someone to come and get the body. And then they had to call all these guys in shell suits to come and disinfect the whole place because of the AIDS thing. And by the time I could go out to try and get some money to try and use, most of the day had gone. And I think from then onwards, I was really on this mission of, I'm just going to use because the same thing's going to happen to me. And my experience, even before he died, of everyone I knew in London since I had moved in there in 91, was that everybody was dying, you know. Everybody who had HIV or Hep C was co-infected. They were all dying, you know. I had friends who were co-infected and were in recovery. They weren't even using, but they were dying. So it was just like, it was a bit of a limbo situation in which I thought, oh, I'm just going to use and then I'll die. And I was a bit scared about that, because I thought, oh, we had me and I'm not going to have anybody. I'm going to be all on my own. So it was a bit scary, but I went on that mission of keep on using as much as I could, and I didn't die. And then one day I woke up and I kind of decided that I had enough, you know. By now I was kind of, I had kind of prostituted myself for a short period of time. I had ended up living with one of my punters. So there was this guy who, I think his MO was like, you know, use kind of working girls and then fall in love with one of them and then move her into his house. And that's kind of what he did with me, you know. He didn't knew I was positive. I didn't tell him because I thought, I was scared that he'd just let me go, you know. So I didn't tell him. I hope I haven't passed on the virus to him, but it's possible that that might have happened, you know. And the wonderful thing about this man was that, as well as being very kind, he was a drug dealer, but he wasn't a drug user. So I think it was the only time during my active addiction that I had drugs on tap, you know, as much as I could, you know, as much cocaine, quite nice, you know, high quality cocaine and quite nice high quality heroin. And I could use it every day, all day, you know, as much as I wanted. And looking back now, I see my addiction because I used to steal drugs from him, you know, because I'd have to have a stash. So I used to steal drugs from him. But because he gave me all the drugs I wanted, and because he was there all the time, I was living in his place, I never had opportunity to use the drugs I had stolen because he gave me as many drugs as I wanted. It was madness. Anyway, he ended up being, I think he was waiting for a trial date because he'd been caught, and then he went, you know, he got convicted and he never even came back home. And then his son came over to ask for the keys back and tell me to go, to pack my things and go. And I knew where he kept his money and his drugs. So I took a bit of a stash with me when I left, and that was it. And then I kind of thought, now I'm going to have to go back on the street, you know, and I couldn't really face that. I still had my flat, but since Louis had died, I hadn't been able to go back there. I'd been sofa surfing ever since, until I moved in with this guy. So I decided that I was going to use those drugs and that money, and once it was all finished, I was going to have to kind of take some kind of drastic measure, really, because I wasn't prepared to go back to that lifestyle, you know. In fact, I think the lifestyle of drug taking got me to in recovery as much as the fact that the drugs weren't working anymore, you know, because the drugs weren't working, but I would keep on taking them for the rest of my life until I died. But the fact that I had to do what I had to do in order to get drugs, that was just like destroying my soul, really, and my spirit. So I went back to the DDU and I spoke to my social worker and I said I want to do like methadone detox. And I went from, I think, 120, 150 mils down to 30, and they got me some funding because these were the good old days where you'd have funding just like overnight. And they sent me to a kind of a really nice place in Salisbury. Really posh place, you know. We had people like, oh, I can't remember his name, Eric Clapton, you know, and Robbie Beeping Williams, you know. All they had like these videos with shares of famous people had gone there. It was expensive. It was really nice. Really nice house, really nice food, just lovely, just a lovely, lovely home. And I was there for a bit, and then I was asked to leave because I knew someone was using and I hadn't kind of, you know, snitched on them. So I ended up being asked to leave. I think the first time they gave me a chance because I said, look, I knew it was using, but I wasn't, and I didn't use, so test me. I'm not going anywhere. I'm desperate, you know. I want to stay here and I want to stay clean. And they tested me and they knew I hadn't used. So they gave me a second choice, a second chance. And on the second chance was my roommate who had this wonderful plan to get her sister to bring her a piece of ash and she would eat it rather than smoke it so no one would know, you know. But she told me and I didn't tell. And second time they just said, you're going to have to go. So you're just too disruptive to the rest of the house, and we've got to protect everybody, not just you, so we're going to have to go. And I went, but I was very determined this time around. Well, I wasn't determined, I was desperate. I knew this was my last chance, you know. I knew if I didn't get it, I'd be in trouble. So I went to a meeting in Salisbury. I stayed in a bed and breakfast. I found my social worker and said, you're going to have to send me somewhere else because they kicked me out and I don't want to go back to London because I'm going to use if I do. So she got me a place in Bristol, and that's where I landed, and that's where I've been ever since. I'm still here on BS10, looking outside of the window while talking to you. And it's home now, it's my adopted home, you know. Home is obviously back in Portugal, but this is like my second home, my chosen home, you know. And I stayed, and I think all together, I stayed in treatment for about 9 months. I got in a relationship, as you do, or as I do, even before I, while I was still in treatment. And then they moved me on to third stage when it all came out, and he stayed there and finished there. And then when I went to this third stage place, they had kind of sweetened me by saying, yeah, we'll work with your relationship when it comes out of treatment, blah, blah, blah. But then when it came out, they were kind of didn't want me to see him. And obviously, you know, being the arrogant, self-righteous, you know, person that I am, self-willed person that I am, I kind of thought, oh, I've been in treatment for 9 months. I don't need you anymore. I can go on my merry way and I can get in this relationship I want to get into and just kind of, you know, do life really. So I left. I think before I was ready, even though at the time I thought I was more than ready, you know, I'd been in treatment for almost a year between primary, secondary and third stage offer house. So I left. I got together with this guy. We stayed together for a while. Then I wanted to have a child because by now kind of all the HIV thing had kind of developed quite a lot. And my doctor had said, you know, you can have a child if you want to, you'll be okay. You won't pass it on to the child. And you've been, you know, I think I was 35 at the time. I was really healthy, you know, really strong immune system. And he said, we can do that. You know, we do elective cesarean. You don't breastfeed, the baby has like a dose of these antiretrovirals when she's born, he or she are born, and everything's going to be okay. And then everything went wrong, you know. I had preeclampsia throughout my pregnancy. She came out when I was only 28 weeks pregnant. I almost died. She almost died. It was all kind of, and then I had postnatal depression that didn't get diagnosed. And then I did 11 months of ribavirin and pegylated interferon to try and get rid of my hep C. And while this was happening, I was too ill to kind of attend meetings or do fellowship, you know. But I stayed clean. So at the end of that, I kind of thought, do I want to go back to the fellowship or do I want to join my then partner who was growing some skunk plants in my house? And I thought, well, you know, I haven't slept, I haven't eaten, I was really in poor health, and what I need is some skunk that's going to give me the munchies so I can start eating again, and some skunk that's going to give me an opportunity to have a good night's sleep, you know. I obviously don't need the fellowship or NA or the program, and maybe I'm not even an addict because I've survived 2 years on my own. And obviously, you know, I've started smoking skunk, and it was a nightmare, really. Nightmare that lasted for about 4 years, you know. And that was like second relapse, because I had already relapsed once for about 10 days back in, I left treatment in 95, and I had about three years clean, and then I relapsed for about 10 days. My partner's mother had died, he had drunk her liquid morphine, and he hadn't invited me, and I was so outraged that I decided that I'm going to show you how to do it, you know. And I went and, my God, I'm getting lost in my life story. I'm so sorry, guys. I'm tired, and I forgot about this share, and I'm all over the place with it. And I've got such a long story and so many kind of tangents, which is something that I tend to get down on, and I just get lost in what I'm saying. Yeah, well, basically, I think what I wanted to say actually was, I've known this fellowship for over 30 years, and I've attended meetings and known about the program and the fellowship for over 30 years, but I'm only clean for. Yeah, so really what I wanted to say was that, when I knew about NA and when I started coming here, I knew two things from my first meeting. I knew I was an addict, and I knew that when I was ready to get recovery, this was the place for me to return to, which was really good because that's exactly what happened. When I was ready to kind of surrender and embrace everything that the fellowship and the program had to offer, that was it. I was free, I've been recovering since then. But within this story that I've been telling you, I had a long period in the fellowship, and this was like from when I first attended meetings in Portugal, when I came to my first rehab in Weston-super-Mare, in which I was still living in Portugal. We had no treatment centers there, so my dad got on a plane with me and took me to this place in Weston. I stayed there for 3 months, and then I had half a pint because I wanted to go home. I was homesick, and I hadn't really any awareness around the fact that if I wanted to go home, I didn't need to drink. I just needed to tell him I wanted to go home, And obviously, as soon as I got home, I was using again. So that was kind of the first kind of treatment experience. And then the second one was when I was ready, was when I asked, was when I shift my hours and went and get it rather than waiting for my parents to pay for it and drop me at the treatment center though. But the first about, I don't know, 17 to 18 years in this fellowship, I basically was just clean, So I've been around for over 30, and I think I had about half of those were just clean, I was doing meetings religiously. I was sharing probably a lot of rubbish religiously, and I was doing service religiously. And as a result of all that, I stayed clean, The first time for 3 years, the second time I was going to say about six, but it wasn't six because then I'd have a kind of a use up here and there, Like I remember going on holiday one day. We went back to Portugal in the car. We drove to Portugal in this little sports car that Steve had bought with the money inherited from his mum, and she died. And he had a big lump of ash, and I smoked that with him. And we got there, and he still had some. But by then, I was home, and I was too scared of my parents finding out I was smoking dope. So I didn't, And then another time, we went to Turkey for a holiday, and we got absolutely plastered one evening, just really seriously drunk. I don't even like alcohol, but I just got drunk to the point of no return. So I, during those 6 years, I'm saying I was clean for 6 years. The second time I wasn't really, because obviously there was these periods of using, but they were like one-off things that started and ended rather than continuing. So as far as I could see, I was being quite successful really. But the truth is that, I was only clean. And that's why those periods happen. And that's why I eventually ended up relapsing, smoking skunk for about 4 years, because I didn't have a program. I didn't have any tools. I didn't have any defenses against addiction. Because the only thing I knew was, meetings and service, I didn't know anything about the steps. I didn't know anything about myself, and I didn't know anything about patterns of behavior, and I didn't know anything about triggers, and I didn't know anything about anything, Anything that was related to the 12 steps was basically kind of alien concepts to me, really. So when I came back in 2008 after these 4 years of smoking skunk, that took me to the same misery and desperation and loneliness and other things as well, because obviously I was smoking copious amounts of the stuff because it was growing it. So I had, Tesco bags full of it, and I was getting lots of visual hallucinations, and I was getting extreme paranoia. So really, I had a few kind of extra symptoms, side effects that I hadn't had the first time around that I was using, but I came back the same way, kind of lost soul, kind of killed spirit, desperate, lonely, and not feeling that I was existing rather than living, no kind of zest for anything. And then I kind of thought, well, I've got to do things differently this time around, otherwise I'm going to end up in the same place, at some point in the future, whether it's 3 years, 6 years, or whatever I'm going to use again. So I embraced the things I hadn't embraced before, which was sponsorship and the steps. And I know, people in this fellowship talk about the table with four legs, and one is service, and one is sponsorship, and one is the steps, and one is the meetings. And they're all equally important. And I acknowledge that. But I know that for me, the steps are definitely the foundation of my recovery. Well, the only recovery I've got, because the first time, like I said, I was only clean, I wasn't recovering. But the steps are without doubt the foundation, the true foundation of my recovery house, really. I mean, I don't always have the opportunity to do service. Today I almost didn't, because I'm a bit of a hairhead and I'm old and I forget. Meetings, the same thing. I mean, let's just think at COVID recently, wasn't it? Thank God for Zoom. The same thing with my sponsor. I don't always, she's a busy girl. I don't always, sometimes I go months without speaking to her. I speak with my sponsees and my recovery friends, but actually my sponsor, I very rarely kind of speak to her or get to kind of spend time face to face with her, So it's like all these things might not be present in a time of need, But then my higher power and my steps are always with me, So I'm really never alone. And I really have with me the tools necessary to kind of, sail any waters, really. And I'm so grateful for that, because I couldn't believe it, why I had been so reluctant for so many years. And I think my reluctance came from the fact that I thought a sponsor was like a mother and I didn't want another one. I didn't get on with mine and I moved away. I moved quite a while, a few miles away, to kind of not have her in my life telling me what to do or arguing with me. Why would I want to get another one, And then the steps was like, why do I want to find who I am? What if I'm as mad as bad and bad as I am when I was taking drugs? It's just that, like, when I took drugs, I was even worse, But what if I'm really evil to start with, So I wasn't really keen on the steps or the sponsorship thing. But then when I came back, I think it was a true surrender in 2008. I kind of realized, actually, I can't afford to say no to certain bits because I don't fancy them. I really need to drop these self-righteous, arrogant kind of attitude and be a bit humble and acknowledge that the first 15 years, I mean, they weren't a total disaster, but they could have been so much better if I had, embarked on the whole journey without any reservations, really. So that's what I did. I got a sponsor. In fact, I asked about four or five women before I got the sponsor, because none of them could do it for all very good reasons. But it left me a bit paranoid and thinking, God, don't stop, don't stop. Just keep asking, you know. And I got one that I thought would be too good for me because she was too calm and collected and soft and nice, you know, and kind, you know. And I kind of thought, my God, I'm going to run rings around this woman. Surely she's not the right person for me. But she's the one who said yes. And someone else who had said no said, why don't you ask Eva? And I said, but Claire, Eva's too nice for me. I don't think Eva's going to do it, you know. Somehow, even though I didn't want another mother as a sponsor, I kind of was looking for, I think, the qualities that I had in my mother in a sponsor. What for? To fall out with her and then not have a sponsor? I'm not sure what I thought. But what I realized was that what I thought I needed wasn't what I needed, you know, because I ended up with a sponsor that was the opposite of what I thought I needed. And she was the dog's bollocks, you know, she was so good. She was fabulous. And I think if she hadn't got ill, I would still have her today. And she just showed me so much kind of love and acceptance and kindness and softness that as well as being a wonderful kind of mentor as a sponsor, you know, she was also the person who kind of allowed me to start healing this issue that I had with my own gender, you know, that obviously came from mommy's issues, you know, my issues with my relationship with my mother. I remember avoiding women's meetings like the plague in the beginning, you know, because when I'd go there, I'd always be comparing myself and I'd always be falling short for one reason or another. For the same reasons, I suppose, that I fell short with my mother, you know, because she was this kind of perfect goddess on the pedestal, was the best at everything she embarked on. Well, now I know she's not, but that's how I saw her at the time. And I'm the perfect mother, the perfect sister, the perfect teacher, because she was a teacher, perfect wife, the perfect this, the perfect that, you know, and I could never live to the expectations that this woman had of me, you know. And that really kind of damaged a lot of my relationships with women, because I constantly compared myself. I constantly saw myself kind of coming up short, and I constantly saw myself kind of, I'm okay with big guys, I'm not really that okay with women, because I just don't feel good when I'm around other women, you know. I always feel less than, you know. So that's the other wonderful thing that Eva did for me. She's like, she allowed me to kind of maintain, nurture, and value my relationships with other women. And nowadays, most of my friends are women, you know, and most of the people I feel most comfortable with are women, you know, because they like me, really. That's why. But for a long time, I didn't see it like that. Here I am going on another tangent. God, I've waffled a lot, didn't I? You guys are probably sick and tired of listening to me. And it was a really discombobulated kind of share. And I've apologized in the beginning, and I'm apologizing again, because I can hear myself in my brain and in my head that it was all over the place. But it's just like, you know, I was bloody filling that skip with earth for about with soil for about 3 hours today, you know, every muscle and bone and nerve in my body aches. And as usual, I went too far, and I done it too much, you know, and I didn't rest, and I didn't feed myself, and I didn't drink, and now I'm a mess. And then I forgot about this chair. So there you go. God, 2 minutes 38 left. I think I'm going to leave it there. But thank you for listening to me. Sorry about the scrambled egg kind of delivery, but that's where I am today. Thank you. Thanks for listening.